Look while you listen live. Visit wildaboutpets.net for more about the show on TalkZone.com.
Welcome back to the show today and our discussion about reptiles. My second guest is Bob Hilger, and he has also been a volunteer member of the Chicago Herpetological Society for over 30 years or so. He specializes in snakes. He's going to speak to us a lot about the pros and cons of owning snakes and some other reptiles as pets. And Bob speaks greatly at all sorts of different kind of events, schools, libraries, at the Society's Reptile Festival shows also. Welcome, Bob. I'm delighted to have you on the show today also.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Franks. I appreciate you inviting me on your radio show.
Well, you're very welcome. To see some of the photos of the snakes and other reptiles we're going to be talking about, you can click the purple Look While You Listen button on my Talk Zone home show page, or if you are on my website, wildaboutpets.net, then you can just click the Look While You Listen button, and our phone lines are open today if you'd like to talk about snakes with us and ask Bob a question. That phone number is 888-463-6748. I'll repeat that. It's 888-463-6748. Okay, Bob, let's talk about snakes. What is the biggest problem you see regarding the ownership of the large snakes such as pythons or boas?
The biggest problem with owning large pythons and boa constrictors is that they do get they do have a tendency to get quite large. The big three is the Burmese python, the reticulated python, and then among the boas, it's the anaconda and the boa constrictor. Those four particular species of large boyites, as we call them, can get quite large. The boa obviously doesn't get quite as big. It can get up to about maybe anywhere between 8 to 10 feet. But it's a standard rule. Any large python or boa constrictor that's over 8 feet in length usually requires two people to handle the animal.
Mm-hmm.
Their diets can range anywhere from large rats, in some cases small pigs, depending on how big they can get. A general rule is the females are always larger than the males. So if you see a large Burmese python over 20 feet long or 20-foot range, it's almost always a female.
Now, isn't it common that people will see these cute little snakes in a pet store and not even really realize what is going to happen in the future?
Well, and unfortunately, that's called impulse buying. People have certain individuals will go into a pet store and they'll become awestruck by the sight of maybe a 12-inch or less than a little over a foot, foot and a half long Burmese python or a boa constrictor. And, you know, based on goofy movies like Snakes on a Plane or Anaconda or some silly movie or some jungle picture, they want to own a piece of the exotic. And without any real knowledge of how to take care of that animal, they'll impulse buy this creature. And the thing with Burmese pythons is when they're born, they're usually around a foot, foot and a half long, mm-hmm. but they can grow rapidly within 3 years. It's a survival instinct in the wild, and the faster they grow, the less they're predated on by large animals. So a Burmese python can go from a foot and a half, well over 8 feet, to 9 feet in less than 3 years, and they can continue to grow at that point. And usually when they reach 8 to 9 feet, the homeowner can no longer maintain the animal in the aquarium that's currently being occupied in. The food items are getting larger and more potentially dangerous because now you're buying large rats in some cases. And then they look for an organization like ours to get rid of the animal.
There is a picture of a Burmese python. This is this kind of yellow and white one, and I'd seen it at Reptile Fest.
Right. Those are fairly common. Herpetologists who breed reptiles, especially snake fanciers, snakes, because of their coloration, can camouflage themselves in their natural environment, so they can hunt for their food and not be attacked. Throughout many different breeds of snakes, is when they have a lot of young, there might be it's not uncommon to have one young that's born albino or born a different shade. And herpetologists and reptile breeders love that because they'll pull that animal out and they'll breed it. Now you have this, you'll have whole generations of albino Burmese pythons or, whatever, albino corn snakes. They call them snow snakes. It's fairly common practice. The problem is those animals can never be released, obviously, wild, but in the wild, that kind of coloration would make them very vulnerable to predation, and it would be easily spotted by predators.
I see. Now, didn't I hear some story, or maybe there's been a couple of them over the years, where people would find like a huge boa constrictor in the wild somewhat on the loose?
Yes, that's quite kind. Unfortunately, it's a real problem now in Florida. The problem comes in that people own these pets, and again, they either have insecure cages to keep these animals in. In the case of Florida, when hurricanes hit, homes are completely torn apart, and these animals get loose. And Burmese pythons are prolific breeders. So, you know, it doesn't take much for a female and a few males to get loose. And if they hook up together, they can produce quite a brood of young. And now we have a substantial population of pythons currently breeding in Florida. And they do wreak havoc on the natural ecosystem. So they're an unwanted pest.
And, of course, there's no natural predators, probably, for...
Well, exactly. In fact, a 25-foot Burmese python is an apex predator, even in its own natural home. I remember seeing an old black-and-white movie clip of Frank Buck, who actually had footage, an Indian python, which is a similar subspecies of the Burmese, actually strangling and killing and eating a leopard in a film. And just recently I saw a documentary about orangutans in Borneo. They had young males in an outside cage that they were going to reintroduce into the wild. And during the night, I think it was a reticulated python had got into the cage and actually strangled and ate one of the smaller orangutans. So these are definitely apex predators. When they reach lengths of 20 to 25 feet, there's very few animals that are going to tackle an animal that size.
All right. Well, the natural next question is then, so if people have these as pets, is there some danger to the family members?
No. I mean, contrary to a lot of horror movies that fall out of trees and attack people from it, I mean, a large python, I mean, if that was the case, there'd be a number of people killed in tropical areas where these snakes are found. It's just simply not the case. There's rare cases where anyone's ever been attacked and even eaten by one of these large pythons. And the main reason is our shoulder bones are too wide. I know it's disgusting, but the python can get the head down, but he can't get past the shoulder blades unless the person's very small. That's not to say they're dangerous. I mean, obviously, they can inflict a painful bite. Their coils are certainly strong enough that if they got around your throat with, you know, two or three coils, they can asphyxiate any size man or woman. But they're not, I mean, if the sad part is what these animals really do is if they do get loose in the natural, in our, like, for instance, if somebody had a large python and they got loose in the city of Chicago, it would never survive the winter. Sadly, one of my son's best friend's mothers called me up a few years ago, and I found a 8-foot Burmese python stretched across their driveway that had froze to death in the middle of December. Somebody had as a pet. So, I mean, they won't survive the winters here. The problem is the danger that they inflict upon the natural ecosystem. Anytime you introduce an animal that's not native to a certain ecosystem, it disrupts the balance, and as a consequence, there's devastating results, as, you know, you see with the Guam brown tree snake did on the islands of Guam to the native bird population. It's just horrific. So, yeah, that's the main danger. I mean, as far as people being attacked or killed, no. I mean, I don't think we're going to see a movie like Snakes on a Plane with their falling out of cart, you know, attacking people under, you know, seats and killing people.
Good. So that's a myth. What about if someone had pets like small dogs or cats, and their boa or their python happens to get a hold of one of them?
Right. Well, exactly. And you know, when I do presentations, I always make this point. I said, you have to understand, when you buy a large python, your animal is definitely, your pet dog or cat are definitely on the food list. Because in their native environment, those animals are eaten. A 20-foot python cannot discriminate between a chihuahua and a rat. Can't discriminate between a cat and a small leopard that it might eat in the jungles. So, I mean, if it's small enough for it to attack and strangle, it'll kill it and eat it. These are not, you know, and the thing you have to understand is pythons and boas, they operate more on an instinctual type of thinking. You can train a dog or a cat tricks. They'll return the affection. A python or a boa might recognize your scent to some degree, but this is not an animal that if you have it in your house sitting on the floor and you roll a ball to it, it's not going to catch it.
Sure.
It's not going to crawl up on the couch and lay in your lap. I mean, it's just not, its intellectual system is not hardwired like that. It's strictly on an instinctual level.
Okay, now what about ball pythons? I used to, when I worked at Lincoln Park Zoo, one of my responsibilities was to go behind the scenes into some of the small animals and reptiles enclosures and bring them out, and I'd give them to some of the docents or volunteers who would be able to hold them so the public could come up. And there was a very wonderful ball python, and there's a photo of one. It's picture number 12, and we can understand why they get that name, because they do kind of wrap themselves into a ball, and they're faces actually are kind of more cute, I would say, and more mammalian than reptile. What about ball pythons? Do they grow as large as like...
Ball pythons is an excellent, what I would call, introductory pet towards larger pythons and boas. I have one myself. The reason why they're called ball pythons is because one of their natural reactions is to ball their body up tight, and they bury their head into their coils. Because the head neck area is very vulnerable to attack. And by balling themselves up, they protect that part of their body so they won't be attacked. They're also called the African royal python. They can get fairly large. I mean, I've heard records, I think in the Herp Society, somebody had one that was over 6 feet long. But their average length is anywhere between 3 to 5 feet in length. They can get as thick as a man's wrist. They're very, very gentle animals. I haven't heard of anyone... having a ball python that was anywhere near aggressive. The thing you have to keep in mind, though, a ball python, like all pythons, they have heat receptor pits along the ridge of their nose, which they use to detect heat at night, I mean, animals at night in the jungles. And that's very cautious to keep in mind, because you should never put a python or a ball python up close to your face, because it's like shoving a hot rock in their face. I discourage people from kissing snakes on the head and putting them close to their eyes and all that stuff. It's not a good thing. But beyond that, no, they're very docile, unaggressive snakes. The only time my ball python ever took a strike at me was because I had the smell of a rat on my hand, and they'd mistaken my hand for the rat. But other than that, no, they're excellent pets.
Okay, speaking about... some of the features of snakes, just for a minute, though, in the picture previously, photo number 11, there's the picture of boa, and its tongue is out. And I know people have a lot of misconception about what that tongue is, and a lot of people think they're stingers.
No.
So, yes, tell us, what is that tongue on a snake?
Every time, if you look at the very front of a snake's face, he has a little tiny, like, triangle-type hole right where the bottom of his front lip is, like a hair lip. Not parallel, but what that is, that allows the snake's tongue to come out without the snake opening his mouth. And what happens is when the snake flickers out his tongue, it acts like an absorbent, and it picks up particles in the air. And then as this forked tongue brings the back into the mouth, there's an organism below the ridge of the nose, between the ridge of the nose and the eyes. It's called the Jacobson organ.
Mm-hmm.
And for all practical purposes, it's a bunch of chemoreceptors. And what happens is the two tips of those tongue will brush against those chemoreceptors, and it'll analyze the data that's on the snake's tongue, and they use it as a form of basically taste testing their environment. A common example as I use in my programs is a rattlesnake will bite a rat. The rat will run off in the woods and die. The rattlesnake will then flicker out its tongue and actually pick up the chemo trail of the dead rat. They use their tongues to find water, to find mates, to find places to hibernate. So their tongue is in a multi-sense organ for these reptiles. If you take their tongue out, they have done experiments, I think, where they've either held the mouth shut or something. But and the snakes did have difficulty, extreme difficulty getting around. So their tongue is a very viable a component of their behavior.
Ah, what a great adaptation.
It is, and it's totally harmless. If they touch you with your tongue, you're not going to die.
Right. Actually,
no snake stinger or anything like that.
No, actually, I think it's really cute when they flick their tongue, and it's I've been tickled by their tongue. I mean, it's the tiniest little tiny tickle. So I would probably surmise that from what you were saying here today, and when you and I were speaking at Reptile Fest, you, and correct me if I'm wrong, really don't think the large, you know, boas, pythons, anacondas are really great pets for the average family.
No. I discourage people from owning those pets unless you have an extensive history of raising snakes. You have a great love for snakes. You've studied up on their behavior. You have the proper cage and locked mechanisms on that cage. You're not reckless with the animal. In other words, you're not the kind of person that likes to walk around crowded areas with a large python draped over your neck and, you know, mm-hmm. or bringing them out to public areas where there's people having a picnic in your, you know, look at my big snake. Letting the animal loose in your house to crawl around because you think it's cute. Mm-hmm. If you're not reckless with the animal and you have a tremendous love for snakes, then it's fine if you want to graduate up to the large pythons. The problem is, it's like somebody wants to own a large, beautiful dog, and they live in a one-bedroom apartment. You know, it's like they want the biggest dog on the block, or the most beautiful, or somebody who rather than get themselves a small cat, wants to own a mountain lion or a caravel, you know, an African wild cat. You have to understand that, you know, these animals do have significant cage requirements and food. And there is a commitment because these animals can live up to 25 years.
That's very long.
In cases up to 30. When you get a large ball or python, you know, there is definitely a time commitment to it.
You had talked to me also about if someone did love snakes, and especially children, and they want to start having a snake. You mentioned corn snakes, garter snakes, and rat snakes, and I also have pictures of them, 10, 11, and no, let's see, think it's 16, 17, 18. Can you talk a little bit about why you think those kind of snakes are better ideas for children?
Well, I'd love to. When I started out as a small boy, the first snake that I ever got was a small little 6-inch garter snake that some kid had caught in a local park. It was probably like 6 years old. I love garter snakes. The most common one in this area is the Plains garter snake. There's also a subspecies called the Chicago garter snake, but for the more common practice, the most one you'll find readily in this area is the Plains garter snake. They're one of the most adaptable snakes in the United States, in my personal opinion. They can survive in temperatures that would kill most snakes. We've actually gone on salamander hunts in the spring where there was still snow on the ground, and these are cold-blooded animals, and they were active, you know. They're found as far north as Canada. Which is a rather inhospitable place for snakes. They're remarkable for many ways. Garter snakes can get fairly large. A plains garter snake, a female, can reach a length of almost 5 feet, but their average length for the males is anywhere between 2.5 to 4 feet long. They eat a wide variety of easily attainable food items, earthworms, goldfish. In some cases, you can actually wean them onto rats, mice. And I had one garter snake train the thing to eat pieces of hot dog. I took a piece of hot dog, tied it to a string, wiggle it in front of him, and he'd actually eat the hot dog, a little chunk of the hot dog. I also trained him to eat little pieces of chicken. They're very smart, in terms of snake intelligence. They're fairly adaptable. They don't require extensive cage requirements. A 50-gallon or 25-gallon aquarium with a lock screen top is more than adequate. If you place it near a window where it's not in total direct sunlight, that's fine. Otherwise, you can use a regular anywhere between a 40 to 100-watt light bulb over the cage and, you know, have it on certain times. A rock in there, a bowl of water, a newspaper for the snake to defecate on, and a hide box, and it's a perfect pet. This is not an animal that if it gets loose in your house, your pet's in danger.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to kill anybody. Again, you know, safe handling. You know, you would never wave a garter snake in someone's face, but,
sure.
You know, proper handling. And it's a very wonderful introductory pet into the raising of snakes. After you've had a garter snake, I'd say for a few years, it'll teach you a lot about how to keep the cage clean, food requirements, all that stuff. The next easiest snake to move into is corn snakes. They're very common in pet stores.
Mm-hmm.
Corn snakes are very docile creatures. They're constrictor snakes found in the rat snake family of Lapidae. They're wonderful animals. The reason why they're called corn snakes is because if you hold them upside, if you hold up the underbelly, it looks like kernels of corn on their belly.
Oh, uh-huh, yes, and one can see that on photo number 16.
Right, and then they also found, they're also found in, obviously, cornfields and wheat fields, and they're there because mm-hmm. of the mice and rats. Now, unfortunately, with corn snakes, now you're moving up the food chain, now you're moving up to mice. If you can handle being a garter snake, earthworms and goldfish and occasional frogs and tadpoles, the next step up is mice. And some people get squeamish about dropping a live mouse or a dead mouse in a cage and feeding a snake. But corn snakes, they can get quite large. They can move up to lengths of up to about 6 feet. So you go from like maybe a 4.5 foot garter snake, now you're moving up to a snake that can reach upwards to 5.5 feet in length. And corn snakes are, again, very similar cage requirements as that of a garter snake. There's nothing different. And then after you've had garter snakes and corn snakes, you can move up to, there's a whole family of gorgeous rat snakes, from gray rat snakes. There's also they can move on up into the king snake family. There's speckled king snakes, and there's these beautiful subspecies called milk snakes, which are, the only problem with milk snakes is they're extremely expensive because they're very beautiful snakes.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there's a whole variety of what they call colubrid. I'm trying to use the Latin term. It's called colubrid. It's C-O-L-U-R-I-A-B-D. I think that's how you spell it. But that's a whole general family of rat snakes, king snakes, milk snakes, garter snakes, water snakes, that are easily cared for as pets.
Okay, and I want to interject, on the Chicago Herpetological Society's website, there is a section that you can find out information about some of the different reptiles, specifically for Illinois, but it's a great source of information, and there's other resources. Now, on my website, Bob, I also did put a couple photographs that I just want to mention in our last few minutes of some of the animals you definitely said you do not believe anyone should own, that being an American alligator, the very large tortoises and snapping turtles, which of course can be very dangerous because of their teeth. I just wanted to mention the last couple pictures, because you also mentioned there are some other reptiles that if someone was going to take them on, like the eastern box turtle or like a little green anole lizard. Can you briefly tell us, I think we got like a minute left.
Okay, eastern box turtles are very easy. I mean, they eat a wide variety. They don't just eat lettuce. You have to feed them a wide variety of vegetable and some protein matter. They're wonderful little turtles to take care of. The problem is they live forever. So, if you're, again, there's a time commitment. Anoles are like little lizards. They're easily obtainable in pet stores. They eat a wide variety. They eat like worms and mainly what we call sprayed mealworms. Those are sprayed little protein. They're very easy to take care of. Again, these are easy introductory reptiles. If you raise a box turtle and you like turtles, you can move on up into bigger and larger tortoises and other more expansive water turtles. The anoles will teach you a little bit about lizards, and you can move on up into, you know, if you want, and several years later, iguanas and even monitor lizards. But no, I don't think anyone other than herpetologists and avid hobbyists should own any caiman alligators. I just don't think anyone should go to the pet store and impulse buy an alligator.
Yes, I agree. And the wonderful thing about Reptile Fest, which is an annual event, and if you go to the website, you can find out more about it, is it is completely an educational show. It's not a place to, you know, buy the reptiles, because as we heard when Dan Nathan was speaking to us, he's talking about your guys', you know, organization primarily, you know, gets rescued animal.
Right.
And is meant to be a place to help, you know, with people who want to adopt them and give these creatures a home. Since they started out being his pets, you know, I think we have a responsibility to them, their welfare and their lives, is no doubt you must believe.
Oh, absolutely. And Dan's absolutely right. One of the sadder facts of our society is we do get, you know, plenty of calls throughout the year for box turtles, Burmese pythons, lizards, and Brett, and I, just as a quick one, I have eight snakes. Seven of my snakes are from former herpetologists and people who can no longer raise them.
Oh, that is sad. Well, Bob, we are out of time. My guest the second segment has been Bob Hilger, also a member of the Chicago Herpetological Society. You can find all my shows. They are archived at TalkZone.com or on my website, wildaboutpets.net. And you can see all the photos. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you both, Dan and Bob, for this great show today.